Welcome to the Tax Update Podcast for Saturday, December 22nd, 2007. This week, washing out a loss, the IRS rules on the IRA's relationship to Section 1091 on the wash sales. Tax Update Podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and the documents may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such prohibited use would include using the podcast or document as part of a continuing education presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Well, it's been a while since we've got one of these recorded, but now we're hopefully getting back in the swing of things. I finished up my continuing education season and being on the road and doing lectures in various locations. So now I'm back in town getting ready for the tax season and taking a look at some of the things that Congress has done, or Congress and the IRS has done recently. Now, for those of you who are not aware, you should be, that Congress gave us not just one, but a group of tax bills before they left town for the holidays. The one that got the most coverage, of course, was the AMT extension on the exemption. But there was also the mortgage relief bill that contained a couple of other interesting little quirks. But this week, I want to look at a new ruling, because the IRS has also been busy issuing a number of interesting and unique rulings in the past couple of weeks as they clean up before the year ends. And one interesting one they just issued involved a question about how you deal with securities held in a taxable account. The taxpayer sells those securities but repurchases them in an individual retirement account. The question to be considered is, does the wash sale rule of Section 1091 have any impact on that transaction? Does it serve to disallow the loss? Now, this had been a topic of conversation on some online discussion groups I remembered from many years ago. And doing some research getting ready for this podcast, I went back and looked in some of the archives in those groups. And this was a hot topic of discussion, actually, it appears, back about 7 years ago. About six or seven years ago, during the time when we went past the year 2000 and suddenly the stock market bubble began busting. And so towards the end of 2000 and in 2001, we began to get more and more questions about whether a taxpayer could harvest a loss in their taxable account. But since they all believed, of course, at that point, just as the bubble was going down, well, it's all going to recover, we know. Now, after 2001, nobody seemed to really buy that recovery real quick option any longer, and so it was less of a problem and went away. But in 2000, the belief was if your stock had gone down, it would recover. You'd like to harvest that loss at the end of the year because you had all those gains in 2000. So the question became, could you harvest that loss but still protect your position by buying the same shares in your individual retirement account? And the issue became like this. As we go to harvest the loss, we would go ahead, sell the shares outside of the account, but at the same time execute an order to buy the shares inside the IRA. Now, that would protect us at least, even though it would be inside the IRA account, and it would be, you know, any return of value during that 30-day period, we'd have to stay out after the sale. Obviously, we couldn't acquire 30 days before. But anything we had during that 30-day period after the sale would now become ordinary income. That appreciation would be stuck in the IRA. But at the end of the 30-day period, we could then buy the shares outside the IRA in terms of buy them on the open market. At the same time, had the IRA sell the shares. And so buy ourselves some sort of a little insurance policy. So at least if it really did go up five times, well, maybe our result would be as good as holding it and having that restored to our basis for capital gain purposes, or have it not restored to the basis, but have it become a capital gain or eliminate the capital loss. It would still be better than having it being held, not held at all, and lose out on appreciation entirely. So back in those days, the question arose, could you do this? Now, Section 1091A specifically applies and says that in the case of any loss to claim to have been sustained from any sale or disposition of shares of stock or securities where it appears that within a period beginning 30 days before the date of such sale or disposition and ending 30 days after such date, the taxpayer has acquired by purchase or by an exchange on which the entire gain or loss was recognized by law, or as entered into a contract or option to acquire substantially identical stocks or securities, then no deduction shall be allowed in Section 165 unless the taxpayer is a dealer in stock or securities and the loss is sustained in a transaction made in the ordinary course of business. For the purposes of this section, stock securities shall, except as provided regulations, include contracts or options to sell stocks or securities. Now, the issue became there, well, the question for the IRA became somewhat simple. The argument was that the issue only applied to the taxpayer, and clearly the IRA is a different taxable entity or non-taxable, quasi-taxable entity, shall we say, from the taxpayer himself. So since the taxpayer had not reacquired the shares while he was economically protected, he didn't trip the literal requirements of Section 1091. Section 1091 did not have any reference to related parties in it. Therefore, the argument went, the sale to the IRA was just fine and good. There's no problem. Also, those practitioners of war note, if you take a look at Section 1091, Section 1091D tells us that what we do with that denied loss is we essentially add it back to the basis of the shares. So we have a disallowed loss. It rolls into the basis of the shares we do have. And then at that point, when we later on a later sale, we then go ahead and pick up that particular basis. In the IRA transaction, there's nothing to attach that loss to. And so the argument goes, obviously, by the way the statute was constructed, there was no intention that such transactions as this would be covered under Section 1091. Now, that may all be all well and good, but in the publications, which, as we all know, are not considered authoritative documents by the IRS, nor are they authoritative for Section 6662 if you're defending yourself against the IRS when they're charging you under 6694, with a preparer penalty, but in the publications, we have a nice little quirk here that tells us that one of the questions in publication 550 that deals with investment transactions specifically discusses indirect transactions and says you cannot deduct your loss on the sale of stock through your broker if, under a prearranged plan, a related party buys the same stock you as own. This does not apply to a trade between related parties through an exchange that is purely coincidental and is not prearranged. Well, clearly the sale to the IRA is prearranged. The sale or the purchase by the IRA is prearranged at the same time as your sale. So under that viewpoint in the publications, we have been on notice at least that the IRS seemed to believe it did not apply, that it did apply. Section 1091 would apply and disallow your loss. But the IRS had never formally ruled. And back when our discussions took place at the beginning of this decade online about this matter, the consensus became that the IRS didn't like the concept, certainly wanted to discourage the concept, but was not yet willing to basically really come down hard and indicate on a formal ruling that they were against the concept. At the time, the conclusion of discussion groups at that point became that there was a strong feeling based on a bit of case law that we'll have a brief discussion of as we go further through this, that based on some case law from the 30s and 40s, that such a related party sale, it certainly seemed like the case law existed to deny the loss, but that because it seemed as if you could argue that 1091 now specifically provided for a more detailed provision of how this should work, and that case law involved trusts that usually had some other bad features that wouldn't exist in the IRAs, for those essential reasons, it would be argued that maybe it was an aggressive position, but one which a client could be warned against, but nevertheless, maybe there was enough support to make it go. Now we're in a different world, and now we have a revenue ruling that comes out and tells us specifically the IRS does not agree with the strategy. The IRS has issued revenue ruling 2008-5. In that, they give us the following fact pattern. X is an individual owns 100 shares of, or A is an individual, owns 100 shares of X company stock with a basis of $1,000. On December 20th of 2007, A sells 100 shares of X company stock for $600. Therefore, as you'll note, triggering a $400 loss. On that same day, the individual causes his IRA account or Roth IRA that's established for the exclusive benefit of that person or that person's beneficiary to purchase 100 shares of the X company stock for their fair market value. A executes a sale and the purchase with different unrelated market participants. Otherwise, to put it very simply, you sell and buy through a broker. You're not going to be using the same person. You're not going to be using the same parties for the real purchase and sale in the open market, except by an extreme coincidence. And A is not a dealer in stock or securities. The IRS concludes at the end of the ruling that the loss on the sale of stock is disallowed under Section 1091. It also holds that A's basis in the individual retirement account or Roth IRA is not increased by virtue of Section 1091D. It goes on to say the ruling does not address any issues other than those specifically addressed herein, and then goes on and says, in particular, this ruling does not address, and no inference should be drawn with respect to, any issuing arising under Section 4975. Now, as an aside, that last sentence is interesting, because Section 4975 is what we have for the prohibited transaction rules. Now, quick review if you've forgotten, that prohibited transactions are bad in a regular retirement account, in a qualified plan, shall we say. They're bad, you know, and they have consequences that make us unhappy. In an IRA, they have consequences that are disastrous because a participation in a prohibited transaction renders the entire IRA distributed to the owner instantly and fully taxable and subject to all the penalties, etc. Now, they say we should draw no conclusions with regard to 4975. What's interesting is they felt they had to say that. Now, there may be two ways I initially view why they brought that up. Way one is to say that the IRS is going to say, we're not saying this is a sale between the individual and the IRA. Of course, though, 1091 never required a sale between the individual and the IRA, or the individual and any third party. With a wash sale rule, I don't have to sell and buy from the same person to trigger the wash sale. So it would seem that even if we had ruled it was a sale from the individual to the IRA, that's a whole separate set of problems. And the loss, you know, and a disallowed and loss would be disallowed under other components of the law. The other suggestion may be that the IRS is kind of in the back door quietly threatening that if you do charge that this does not apply, 1091 does not apply, the IRS may be saying, well, then maybe we want to look at whether or not this prearranged sale that had all the equivalents as if you had sold it directly to the IRA, since you got rid of it and the IRA got it and the money the IRA gave up essentially is the same money you got subject to commissions, that there's a disguised 4975 in there. So maybe you prefer the 1091 approach. Tough to know why it's there, but it was an interesting last sentence to throw in there. Because as I note, to me, there was no apparent reason why anybody would have gone down the 4975 route reading this particular ruling. In any event, let's go on and see what exactly the IRS is after. Now, the IRS will agree with us in this ruling that we don't literally violate Section 1091. But they're going to argue that violating the spirit of Section 1091 still causes us to have a problem. Now, the main case they support, they reference specifically a case, Security First National Bank of Los Angeles, an old Board of Tax Appeals case. Now, the IRS summary of that case indicates the taxpayer sold bonds at a market price to a corporation of which the taxpayer is a sole shareholder. On the same day, in exchange for land, the corporation transferred the bonds at the same price to a trust over which the taxpayer had absolute dominion and control. Now, it's useful to note in this case that the court was concerned with a couple of transactions. They were concerned that the particular trust in structure due to which all of the trust was taxed back to the grantor, and this is prior to the statutory grantor trust rules being there, and that he could easily revest title in himself. I think it is simple when you read the case to distinguish this particular trust from an IRA. But that's not necessarily the IRS's point here, as I suspect, not necessarily the exact facts of this case, but they love a particular quote, which they do reproduce in the revenue ruling, when the court discusses its reasons for ruling against the taxpayer in the Security First National Bank case. And what the court said there was that the taxpayer did not personally reacquire substantially identical property, and strictly construed, the language of 214A5 above referred to might not apply. Now, that's under the old Internal Revenue Code, the 1939 code. Remember, we got a renumbering in the 50s, and we're currently under the renumbered set of codes, so you have to watch when you're reading these old cases that the code number references, you have to go back and do the remapping of the two. But continuing with the court's discussion, however, the rule of strict construction should not be unduly pressed to permit easy evasion of a taxing statute. Quoting Carbon Steel Company versus Llewellyn from a U.S. Supreme Court case, unless the respondent is right, which the respondent, remember in this case, the IRS, a trust like this one could be used deliberately to accomplish the very thing Congress intended to frustrate. Although title of the bonds was acquired by the trust, actual command over the property was still in the taxpayer. The difference between acquisition by him personally and acquisition by the trust amounts only to a refinement of title and may be disregarded so far as Section 214A5 is concerned. The IRS note here is the intent and the position taken in this case that since the intent of the wash sale rules was to keep someone from basically washing out a loss without having economic circumstances change, that that would apply to the IRA situation. Now, personally, I find more persuasive on point the second case the IRS notes, which they reference in passing, Schoenberg versus Commissioner from the Sixth Circuit. Again, going back a number of years into the 30s. In that case, a taxpayer had a broker simultaneously sell securities he held personally, trigger a loss. Then he held a corporation he held a 70% interest in, and his mother held a 30% interest in, reacquire the identical securities. So basically, the broker was given two orders, sell and buy, exact same numbers of securities. Sell from my personal account and buy that exact same pocket of securities over here in the corporation's account, a corporation which I control and which all remaining interests are held by a close relative. The course held directly on the sale of whether these facts, these were separate entities for tax purposes, negated the wash sale rules. And the Sixth Circuit held that it's argued that the investment company taxpayer separate entity must be considered so here. Granting that they were, the domination of the company by the taxpayer was complete, and in this transaction, it was no more in effect and substance than his alter ego. Now, that would seem to be a lot closer to what we see in the IRA context. It's not identical because in that case, there was a 30% interest controlled by somebody who was not the taxpayer and who conceivably, you know, he could have been giving up something. There was some change in circumstance, so it wasn't total identity. But the practical consideration the court's noting here, from all practical purposes, he basically didn't change his economic situation dramatically, and he had all the reason to believe that his economic situation would remain identical. The court also noted that this was clearly a plan to work around the wash sale rules. It noted, examining this entire transaction, it is clear that this sale by taxpayer was merely part of a plan by which he hoped to create a tax-deductible loss without any real change in his position. At the times he directed Taroker to sell particular stocks, he also gave instruction to purchase identical stocks for the Globe Investment Company. Just over the 30-day period of the statutes, he purchased those same stocks from the Globe. He had complete dominion over the Globe as to its purchase by it, by its retention of stock for resale to him, as to such sale by it to him. For all practical purposes, he used Globe as the agency for purchasing, holding, and selling to him stocks identical with those which he used to establish the claim loss. That these actions by Globe and his use of Globe was part of a plan which included the sale by him is clear. It was fully carried through. He was no poorer when the plan was executed than he had been before the sales by him, except for the brokerage commissions. He suffered no real loss, but solely a paper one, which could be shown only by considering one part of an entire plan and transaction. The entire plan was devised for purpose of showing such loss. Its results must be judged as an entirety. In this case, the court held that it was a wash sale, and he was just out of luck as far as it went in terms of deducting that loss. The key issue was there was a plan in place, and the wash sale provisions did not establish an absolute bright line for by which, as long as you stay away from the requirements, you are fine. Now, the key question to be decided is the IRS correct on this position? That is, can the IRS look beyond the strict formal requirement, Section 1031, which serves merely as an absolute bar, meaning if you fail 1091, you're out, but merely avoiding 1091's explicit provisions by itself does not mean you get to deduct the loss. And that is our question. So if the taxpayer is engaging in a transaction that is clearly designed to work its way around Section 1091 using his IRA or Roth IRA account, does the IRS really have the authority under this to issue this ruling and deny the loss in question? And as well, the next question, which is not really addressed in the cases they discuss, if that is true, do we truly just lose the basis? Is the basis gone, never to be deducted by the taxpayer? Now, we do have transactions where that's true. For instance, when a corporation sells property to the shareholder at a loss, we have just lost basis. We never see that basis reappear anywhere. Now, but in other transactions in the code where we have a sale disallowed with related parties, the related party later gets lost. Well, the IRS could argue in this case, that's fine. The IRA gets the loss, and who cares? That is, the argument may be that the basis goes to the stock inside the IRA, which, of course, does us no good whatsoever, because in there, it's not going to make any difference. But that is the very issue. Now, the key is the smell of these transactions has always been a little bit troubling, I think, to most of us, because certainly it does appear we are trying to work our way around it. And it's not difficult to see a court going along with this view, and especially based on those court cases, although they are somewhat long in the tooth. But going along with those court cases, this is merely a device to get around what was Congress's explicit desire not to allow people to generate paper losses and be able to take them. And given the new provisions of Section 6694 effective for 2007's returns, it's also extremely important to consider that if you take a position contrary to this, you will be going against the published guidance of a revenue ruling, which has implications for both 6694A and 6694B. And that is a potential issue. Now, we may find a problem here because we're going to find that some of our taxpayers, since this was issued late in 2007, we may have had taxpayers, some of us may run into taxpayers, who had their broker or some other advisor advise them that this was a way to avoid the wash sale problem. Well, we want to get rid of this loss. And many clients have already executed some year-end strategies to, to get losses to offset their gains from earlier in the year. And it is very possible that just prior to this being issued, a client could have gone in, sold stock at a loss, and the broker could have repurchased those identical shares in the IRA account, and everybody could have told the client in question or taxpayer in question, oh, this is fine, you can do this, the wash sale's not triggered. Now the client comes to you after the beginning of the year and informs you of this fact, and now you have a problem because the client's going to say, well, this guy told me it was fine, the broker says it's fine, and he told me it was all well and good. And even worse, perhaps, maybe it happened early enough that you even discussed with them and you, based on the prior law, you said it was an aggressive position. But so far, there's nothing obviously that goes against it at this point that comes down and says that we absolutely can't do it. Now you're stuck with a revenue ruling on point. Well, let's consider the issue of that if you decided you're going to do that. For the purpose of 6694A, and remember, we're now going to be past the point where we're in the transition mode. So this will be for a 2007 return for which the more likely than not standard will be applicable. And at that point, we have to consider the relevant authorities for the position if we're going to do it and not disclose the fact that we are going contrary to a revenue ruling. In this particular case, clearly it seems like the revenue ruling is the only thing we've got that is truly on point on this particular transaction. We have court cases, and those court cases we can find all seem to lean the other way. It is difficult, aside from arguing straight from the code and trying to straight bang the code and say, this doesn't literally meet the requirements, and we have these whole court cases that tell us, well, literal meeting of the requirements isn't completely necessary for these types of related party transactions. But since we don't literally meet the requirements, we should get the deduction. Compare that with the fact that we have a published revenue ruling that explicitly states if you sell and the IRA reacquires, the loss is disallowed. It would seem difficult to meet or next impossible to meet, more likely than not. In fact, you're going to have to find authorities to back you up to get to the reasonable basis standard so that we are able to, even with disclosure, include this on the return. Now, a little more interesting is 6694B. Now, reasonable basis standard, if you take a look at that, like most of these, is actually defined in a 6662 standard. And we're told that reasonable basis is a relatively high standard of tax reporting that is significantly higher than not frivolous or not patently improper. It's got to be reasonably based on one or more of the authorities that set forth in the regulations under 6662, taking into account the relevance and persuasiveness of those positions. So it's more than just a non-frivolous position. We're going to have to be able to point to authorities if we take this position, even with disclosure. Under Regulation 66, Code Section 6694B, the reckless disregard of the rules, that's a different problem. There, revenue rulings are considered under Regulation 1.66943F as to be one part of the rules or regulations for which disregard can trigger the 6694B more significant penalty. That's the $5,000 penalty, plus the referral over to the Office of Professional Responsibility just for fun. Under the current regulation, which may very well be modified, because the current regulation says you can avoid the penalty for disclosed positions that are not frivolous and for revenue rulings, even for an undisclosed position that meet the realistic possibility standard, the 1 in 3 rules. Now, it's important to note those standards may change in regulations here shortly because those standards were tied to the old 6694A levels of authority you needed for taking a position with disclosure for any average run-of-the-mill position. So contrary to a revenue ruling, we may find that we're going to see those two positions switch from realistic possibility and not frivolous to more likely than not and reasonable basis for that purpose. So we may still need to cover just as for 6694. If we fail 6694A, we may also by default fail 6694B. That was certainly the true of the old regulations if you had a revenue ruling in play. If you couldn't basically go against the A, you had a real problem on the B. We may see that referred back to. And again, remember the B is the more significant penalty and the more serious one of the two. Now, as a practical matter, I think historically many of us counseled to our clients that this was a shaky position at best. And one that would be a little more interesting to defend, and the IRS may very well not agree with it, but it was one that had a low disclosure, discovery possibility, simply because the transaction took place inside of some place that it was not likely the IRS was going to be looking at, so they would see the sale, but they wouldn't see the repurchase in the IRA. Now, that could be an interesting aside and a unique little problem. The other side that may be interesting would be to consider the possibility of what if your client has multiple investment advisors? What if, in fact, the IRA is under control of an investment manager and perhaps a manager who executes and the taxpayer accidentally triggers this just because over here in the IRA account, the manager has a slew of things he wants to purchase. Taxpayer says, oh, that sounds good. Go for it. And on the taxable account, the advisor comes back and says at the same time, oh, we want to sell these things. So there's no pre-designed plan. My guess is that while the revenue ruling doesn't seem to contemplate the fact that the revenue ruling may end up not applying in that case because the case law and everything else we see here requires a prearranged plan. And if you could show that it happened, but there was no prearranged plan to make it happen, the taxpayer might very well be in okay position. But similarly, if the taxpayer is involved in other transactions, and for instance, let's say the IRS invests via an investment partnership, and we know the partnership is going to be selling, going to be acquiring these securities, and we dump them outside, well, that might be enough of a prearranged plan. Be an interesting case to look at, but this is an interesting development that came down. Even of more interest is, since this has been an issue that's been out there for years, the fact that the IRS finally in 2007 decided now was the time to issue the ruling, even though the discussions have gone on for a long time. This has been the tax update for Saturday, December the 22nd, 2007. We are getting here, closing out to the end of the year, getting all the pieces together and getting your tax planning ready for your clients. And hopefully that is all wrapped up here as we enter this final week, get into the holiday season and prepare for our next tax season. And I will take a look. We've had a few other developments I want to go over, take a look at, and get some more podcasts out on. So we'll be talking about some of these more recent cases that have come down and see how everything's developed, plus the new law that we had just passed for us, including, just as a heads up, be sure if you haven't already noticed, in the mortgage bill, there has been a change to the penalty for late filing of partnership and S-corporation returns. For partnership returns, the late filing penalty has gone up on a per-partner basis. S-corporation returns, we had added for the first time a per-shareholder penalty for late filing. So in the past, while we often thought there was no penalty or no problem, if an S-corporation went late, that wasn't an issue because if there was no tax due, no built-in gains tax, no excess passive income tax, there was effectively no penalty at the federal level for late filing or S-return as long as we didn't have an election that needed to be filed on a timely return. Note that that has now changed in the law for all returns due after the date of this law. So be very careful. The effective date of this law is going to change that. So that means that for 2007 returns, most likely, presuming the president signs the bill before the president signs this bill, which it's almost certain he will, we're going to need to educate our clients that yes, missing an S date is going to cost you some money in penalties. This has been the tax update for December 22nd. Remember, the tax update is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Be sure to go to their site, take a look at their offerings to keep you up to date on developments in various aspects of tax law during the year with their mailing list, plus access to their library of information on a number of issues of interest to tax practitioners.